Technology has made it possible for many of us to work from anywhere. But technology has also made it seem necessary for some of us to work all the time and from everywhere. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The proliferation of laptops over the last 20 years sparked the telecommuting revolution and gave us the catchphrase, flex time. Today, we're going to talk about how work in the United States has evolved and explore the pros and cons of being able to carry your work in your pocket. I'll talk with Joanne Marshall, author of Juggling Flaming Chainsaws, Benjamin Honeycutt, author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, and sociologist Kevin Light. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Thanks to smartphones, right now many of us have in our pocket the ability to communicate with our coworkers and accomplish real work anywhere, anytime. That gives us the ability to pick up the kids or go away for a long weekend, but it also means that some of us can't get through a family dinner without some kind of interruption. This hour, we're going to explore the evolution of the modern workplace and talk about the pros and cons of the technology that tethers us to our work. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Benjamin Honeycutt, author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, and Kevin Light, director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa. My first guest this hour is Joanne Marshall. She is Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at Iowa State University and author of Juggling Flaming Chainsaws, Academics in Educational Leadership, Trying to Balance Work and Family. Hello, Joanne.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And your research about work-life balance came out of your own personal struggle. What was going on in your life?
Well, I had this epiphany at a conference, my very first conference, professional conference. I had to take my newborn along with me. So we arrived in the hotel lobby and all my colleagues are there looking professional. We have a huge truck behind us with plastic. And so it sort of caught between presenting at sessions, then going back and nursing and taking care of the baby and then coming back. And the second time that happened with my second child, I thought somebody has got to have figured out a better system than I have. And so I convened a bunch of my colleagues to get together and talk about strategies for ways to balance the work and family challenges. And that's how that came about.
And as you started talking to your colleagues, what did you find? Did you find that other people had discovered this better way?
Unfortunately, no. No one has a better way. It's a constantly negotiated position, I think. And people often ask, so what's the answer? Well, the answer is that I think everyone is struggling with this. It's not just a mom issue. It's not just a women's issue. It's not just a partnered issue. It's everyone is really struggling with how to cut out time for themselves, time for their families, and also make ends meet with a job in this economy.
Now, you gathered essays and stories from a lot of other people in academia, but it strikes me that what you discovered applies to a lot of other different kinds of workplaces as well.
Absolutely. Long before I started discovering this as a topic, people have written about the greedy institution of work, the idea that workplaces will take whatever they can get from you. And Joan Williams talks about this as the ideal worker norm. The ideal worker is someone who never takes time off, who doesn't get sick, who doesn't have any family emergencies that might interfere with getting the work done. And for a long time, people have gone along with that. And as you've noted, technology has also stretched the work that we do and the time that we have. And so the boundaries really have to be set up by us.
Now, in academia and many other workplaces, there is a structure that is an archaic structure, but it seems that most of these businesses and worlds have been built for married men who have mm-hmm. women at home who are playing the supporting role. And do you think those structures remain in a lot of places?
Oh, you're exactly right. And academia in particular, the tenure track is all built on, you will do as much research as possible, and at the end of that time, we will either keep you or let you go. And that was assuming that you could devote all of your time to your research, that there wouldn't be, birthday parties to buy presents for or laundry to be done or anything like that. So you're right. The structures are old. But time and people have changed. So some of the time studies that have been done recently talk about men, are doing far more housework and childcare than they ever have before. Women are doing far more paid work than they have before. So men and women are really working equally, and yet it's really hard to manage that within the context of the way jobs are set up.
Do you think that there's still a double standard in the workplace when a woman has to leave to pick up a child who is sick? Is there a different judgment than if a father, a man, has to do that?
There is some good research that talks about the gender expectations around that. So, yes, exactly what you said. If a woman leaves a meeting early to pick up a sick child, then that's kind of a mom thing. And she's kind of viewed as not as much a professional. If a dad does that, then he's viewed as a really good dad. That's just wonderful, and it benefits him. Except if he continues to do that too much, then there becomes some sort of ineffable tipping point at which he's not considered a real man anymore. He's considered more like a mom. Therefore, his gender and his masculinity are in question, which is interesting and unfortunate.
I used the phrase work-life balance, and that's something that has been kicking around for a long time.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
There has been a shift. The National Science Foundation has started referring to work-life satisfaction instead of balance. Why do you think that there has been that change?
It's interesting. I think work-life balance, that phrase puts the responsibility on the individual. So it's my responsibility to determine how I can do this. I have to be in balance. The work-life satisfaction also puts some back on the employer, I think, in order to make sure that your employees are satisfied or willing to stay. And especially in the STEM fields, when you're talking about retention of women, that becomes a more important issue.
Do you think that workplaces are responding to that?
Some. I think higher education has led the way a little bit on that. The national institutions have recommended, for example, that there be more flexible tenure clocks. And certainly Iowa State and University of Iowa both have done that. Colleagues across the country are really jealous of the flexible work policies that we have when I talk about them. So they really have led the way. In some regards, I think that there's more work to be done, especially at the middle level, that there may be support at the higher institutional provost office level, whether there is that down in the middle level of departments where things are negotiated on a daily basis is not quite as clear.
Now, I've been a journalist for a long time, and I remember in the 90s and the early 2000s, we were doing a lot of reporting on how the workplace was changing. And there were a lot of stories about places that had instituted on-site childcare, mm-hmm. places where they would allow you to keep your baby with you at work until they were 6 months old, places with on-site wellness programs, mm-hmm. and all kinds of perks. Because, of course, when the economy was booming,
right.
they needed workers, and they needed workers who were willing to stay with them. And then, of course, we hit this big recession and suddenly things changed again. Do you think that there has been a lot of backsliding in workplaces caring about their employees' satisfaction?
I think so. I mean, my perspective, of course, is at the university, and we don't have some of those things that you mentioned. I think that, at Star State University, appropriations have been decreasing, as you're probably aware, which means that the work continues to go up with fewer staff. And I think that's been a shift. And we're all very fortunate to have jobs. And so I think people often just swallow the extra work in terms of, well, I'm glad I have a job at all. I need to feed my family. So here we go. And I will do whatever it takes to make that happen. How to fight back, I'm not really sure how to do that in this economy.
Right. Is there going to be a shift where things start to go the other direction? Or once organizations work with a leaner staff, do they ever bulk up again?
Yeah, I really don't know the answer to that.
How about you? I mean, we're going to spend a lot more time talking this hour about how people can harness technology to give them flexibility in the workplace and the double-edged sword that is. Are you plugged in all the time?
I try not to be. We have house rules, so we do not allow devices in our bedroom. We do not allow devices at the dinner table. And we really try not to check and I say we because I have an academic spouse also, we try not to check email during weekends. There are some things that are unavoidable, deadlines that come up, things that have to be done, but we try to carve out the time.
Do you feel ever that that puts you at a disadvantage with other colleagues who maybe don't have those boundaries?
Perhaps. I think the stereotype is that single people really get taken advantage of because everybody else says, oh, well, you don't have a family. You can, you know, do this committee or you can do that. And I think it's work life is an issue for single people also. You know, everyone needs to carve out the time to exercise, you know, walk the dog, go to church, you know, whatever it is that keeps them centered and grounded and healthy. And that's not a single person or a married person issue. That's an every person issue.
This book that you've written, Juggling Flaming Chainsaws, you've called this the first in a series. What other issues are you hoping to explore in the future?
There's one for graduate students that's already in the works. One of the book reviews that we received from Teachers College Record also suggested that we look more at diverse perspectives from specific ethnicities. And so we have one coming out for Latina educational administrators. There's one in the works for women in particular and how they work on that. I think that any field probably could write their own. You know, we chose educational leadership because that's our field, but you could choose economics, you could choose farming, you could choose anything. And I, as a series editor, I would welcome proposals in any of those. If someone's listening and wants to send me one, I'd be happy to hear about it.
In talking to a really diverse group of people for your first book, did you find that there is a group of people that tends to struggle with this work-life balance problem more than others?
No. You know, maybe parents of young children are figuring it out more, but there really is an incredible amount of just life that interferes with work. So even as we were putting together the book and deadlines were coming up, people would be writing me and saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't make the deadline because my daughter had emergency surgery. Oh, I'm so sorry, I can't make the deadline because we have to move. You know, it's just these things. I'm surprised any work gets done at all at times because everyone is struggling with something and you don't know what that is.
And you found that men struggle with it as much as women today?
I would say especially those who are really trying to be involved in their children's lives, yes.
So maybe we've reached equality at last where we're all struggling equally?
Perhaps. I think it's an economic issue and a quality of life issue. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book by Liz Hollingworth at University of Iowa who talks about, you know, being raised and trying to make a difference, being raised as a child of divorced parents and really trying to then make a difference, you know, to make sure that doesn't happen in her own family. And I think that's a common concern.
Joanne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. That was fun.
Joanne Marshall is an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Iowa State University and author of Juggling Flaming Chainsaws, Academics and Educational Leadership and Work-Family Balance. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the evolution of the modern workplace, how technology has freed us and tethered us at the very same time. And we would love for you to join our conversation as well. Tell us how having a smartphone, having the ability to work wherever and whenever has changed your life in good ways and in bad. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me now is Benjamin Honeycutt. He's professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. Hello, Benjamin.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here today, sir. Kevin Light is also here. He's a professor, department chair, and director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa. Kevin, thank you so much for being here today.
Pleased to be here and pleased to be with Ben.
And let's get a little bit of a history lesson here. Ben, let's start with you. The 40-hour work week is pretty standard in the United States. How did we get there?
A long process, what I've called for a long time the century of shorter hours. The definition of progress in this country for a long time was higher wages and shorter hours. Certainly among the working class folks in the labor movement, those two things constituted what it meant for our nation to get better, to progress. For over a century, that was sort of the rallying cry of the labor movement, shorter hours and higher wages. Over that period, century of shorter hours, working hours are cut almost in half. To 1938, the 40-hour week is sort of comes in, but no one thought that this process would end, that the 40-hour week would somehow become standard. Indeed, quite the contrary. No one predicted a stabilization. Everyone who observed this process predicted that it would continue, and that by 1980, George Bernard Shaw, Julian Huxley, John Maynard Keynes predicted that we'd be working 2.5 hours a day. Clearly, that didn't happen. What happened was what I've called the great leisure mystery. The working hours stabilized. After the Great Depression, after the Second World War, working hours remained constant at around 40. And recently, over the last three decades, have indeed gotten longer. By some accounts, Juliet Shore, for example, we are working about 5 weeks more now per year than we did in the mid-1970s, and that trend line continues. Not only are we working longer per year, but over our lifetimes, we are now retiring later and later. Even though we're living a bit longer, we are using more and more of our longer lifespan, devoting them to work, and so the decrease of work is not happening. In fact, we're going the opposite direction, and as your previous guest had mentioned, more and more women are entering the workforce, so the workforce is growing. More and more of us are working. More and more of our lives are devoted to the workplace, hence the stress. Technology once was seen as a freer. Labor-saving device was a really popular phrase through the 19th and most of the 20th century. Now, we'd find our machines, our cell phones, our computers and emails enslaving us, making us work long after we've left the workplace. The long arm of the job, at least for some of us, is extending more and more into our private lives.
Well, and I think that there was an interesting shift because, as I mentioned earlier in the show, about 20 years ago, laptops became pretty common. And when laptops became common and people could take their work home with them, suddenly there were people who said, hey, maybe I could just do this work from home. Think of all the advantages that I could have if I didn't have to spend all that time commuting and if I didn't have to worry about taking my children somewhere before I could work. That did seem like a tremendous amount of freedom, this telecommuting revolution.
But quite the opposite happened. The American Psychological Association, in a study of 2008, found that ordinarily, most of us are working about 42 hours per week. Those of us who telecommute or telecommute part of the job work about 46 to 48 hours per week. So telecommuting, those of us who telecommute are working significantly longer hours than those of us who have a traditional job and 8 to 5 sort of thing.
Now, I've read about different reasons for that. Some people think that it's because people who telecommute don't have that FaceTime with their boss. They feel like they have to work harder to prove that they're working. what do you see as the reasons behind that?
I think there is a culture, a work culture in our society where we expect it, at least those of us who have good jobs and who are engaged with our workplace. There's a culture of work that and our expectations is that we begin to devote more and more of our lives, in fact, have our life completely devoted. The work is in first place. The result is stress, work stress. American Psychological Association, several other people have studied work stress, and the Psychological Association finds that stress, job-related stress, is the number one stressor that people report in the United States. Am I stealing your thunder, Kevin?
No, not at all.
It's a stress. Stress is increasing. As the hours increase, I've written a couple of things that I describe the phenomenon as that we become long-distance runners plunging headlong at a sprinter's pace.
running
as fast as we can to keep our place.
There we need to talk about the dichotomy here too, because we are talking about white-collar work.
Exactly.
We're talking about salaried positions where you're not getting paid for the hours that you work and you're devoting all of this time and energy to your jobs.
Exactly.
And now at the same time, there are people who do get paid hourly who can't seem to get 40 hours a week to save their lives or to support their families.
Just really, really quickly, a recent Gallup poll within the last 2 months has found that 70% of the poll that they did that covered white-collar as well as blue-collar workers were not engaged in their job or actively disengaged. Only 30% of us are engaged. What that means is that we're looking to our job for community, for a purpose, direction, that we fulfillment. We are really engaged in finding in our job some of those satisfactory, those things that we find satisfactory, fulfillment and so forth, creativity, meaning, purpose, identity, and only 30% of us. And those 30% are those exact people who are running into this stress thing, that more and more of their life, even though they're engaged with their job has engulfed them.
When did that ideal come about? Because of that, we are brought up to think you can find meaningful work. You need to figure out what you really want to do with your life. And when you find that, you will be happy.
I wish I knew. I spent the last 40 years of my life trying to understand the end of shorter hours and why it is that work has become such a Robert Hutchins at the University of Chicago, I guess no one really knows him. He's he used to be a famous president at the University of Chicago, called salvation by work. As we are losing our traditional faiths and looking around for different ones, we're looking to our jobs to answer those questions of our humanity that we all have. Who am I? How can I find a meaning and purpose in this life? Where am I going? What must I do to be saved? All of those things for most of us. And we teach this at university. If you work hard, if you put your mind to it, you will find a Prince Charming of a job where all of your needs, and some of us are lucky enough to find such a thing. But for the vast—
Maybe one in 10 of us, yeah.
Well, 70%, the Gallup poll says. The book that I'm now working on, I hope I'll finish before I die, is Saving Work, A Failing Faith. I really think that this new religion, what Robert Hutchins called salvation by work, is not doing it for us. It's a false God. It's a failing faith. And that causes a lot of stress and anxiety. And God, I see it in my children who, you know, if I could only find a job and find this Prince Charming, but perhaps it's not going to be possible for a whole lot of us.
So the modern American dream has become a modern American fairy tale.
A utopian myth.
On multiple dimensions.
All right. We're talking about the evolution of the modern workplace today, technology, how it has freed us and enslaved us at the very same time. With me, Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. Kevin Light, professor, department chair, and director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. Let us know how technology has changed the way that you work. Do you like it? Does it allow you to do things you couldn't have done before? Do you ever wish you could go back? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. And Kevin, let's talk about how this changing workplace, this changing idea of work, spending more and more hours engaged with our work, how has that changed the rest of our culture?
Well, it's definitely changed the rest of our culture. And one of the reasons we're spending endless hours at work is because our wages haven't gone up. So one of the hidden dynamics that's driving the perpetual belief that we all have to be attached to the workplace all the time is our wages basically haven't risen in real terms since the early 1970s for a vast majority of us. So now, as Ben's research and writing has pointed out, we're putting 80 or 90 hours a week into a labor market as a family to buy things that 40 hours worth of work used to buy, or even less than that. And so we're essentially, as he put it, going faster and faster and faster, running in place or even falling behind. So it is having – I think it's not only having a big effect on the workplace, but it's having a profound effect on the rest of our culture as well, not only because we spend so many hours at work. Now it has to fulfill us. It's the religion that has to do the job, and it's not going to do that job. But then we constantly talk about family values, but family values require two things that this type of environment doesn't produce: time, which we're robbed of, and money, which we do not have. And as most of us know that are listening to this, family values cost money. It'd be a nice bumper sticker for a political campaign. I voted for X because family values cost money. But in the United States, family values don't cost money. We just, you know, complain that there aren't enough people married, or, you know, there are a bunch of kids wandering around or unsupervised. And we don't tie that back to the obvious fact that, well, their parents are working all the time and their wages are going backwards. So a lot of the other things in life we don't like are tied to the fact that not only do we work a lot of hours, but we don't get paid very much for what we actually do.
Well, I think a lot of us think about how things changed in the 1980s and 90s when more and more women were going into the workplace. And there was this explosion in the daycare industry, which, of course, for working parents, that's where a lot of our money goes, is quality childcare while we're at work. But now it seems that in the last 10 years, maybe even last 5 years, we're going further and eroding those hours when we are at home. Is that the shift that you're seeing now?
Yeah, that's definitely the shift we're seeing now. But notice going back even to the 1990s, as you were talking about in the first segment, when we talk about work-family life programs, what most of those programs did was make it easier to work more hours. They actually didn't make it easier to do family things. They got all of your family stuff out of the way so you could work more hours. So there was on-site daycare. There was on-site pediatricians to take care of your children. They're on-site drivers to drive them around to various places, all in order to get a very high-skilled workforce to work ceaselessly. The idea wasn't to make family life better. The idea was to literally tie you to a chair. So that's been a big part of this. And now that you can take those devices home, we see problems even further. I mean, Dalton Conley actually has a book about this. It's called The Elsewhere Society, where there's basically a total disengagement with the people that are right in front of you, and you're dividing up your attention between the people that are in front of you and the half a dozen people that are electronically tied to you all the time. And so that has cultural implications as well, so for our children and for us.
Well, we have a post on Facebook that speaks exactly to that, and this is from Vince, and he's a news director at a public radio station, a friend of mine. He says, the fact that work is always in my pocket means that work is also always on my mind. As my wife says, I may be present, but I'm not home. It's also tough to tell the teens they cannot text at the table when dad will absolutely not ignore a work text or a call during a meal. I have a feeling that Vince is not alone.
Certainly. It's a stress factor, that being always on call. The job is taking us away from – my wife is a marriage and family counselor, and she talks a lot about the impact on relationships this divided mind has, that we are never with the people that we're with. We're never in the present. We divide our attention, and that's hard on the people around us that we face eye to eye. It makes for a divided soul, a divided mind, and a stress. It's a definite stressor in our culture.
Who gets the brunt of this? I mean, I mentioned we're talking mostly about white-collar work, but are there positions in organizations that tend to be the people who are impacted most by this constant tethering to technology?
I think middle managers and salespeople, in my experience, have it the worst. So until very recently, I would be in airports and I would be talking to middle managers and others, and their boss was constantly tethered to them. And it was a sign that you were a boss that was engaged if you were constantly sending communications to your employees below you, asking for reports, having data collected, asking how the last sales call went. And a lot of them have started, I think rightly, to push back. And so the book reps that come to the University of Iowa now have a rule that their boss gets to talk to them one time a day, and that's it. Otherwise, the boss is interfering with me doing my job because they can.
Right.
Because you're tethered to your cell phone.
And that's the boss with their cell phone proving that they're doing their job as well.
Yes. So to some extent, that we as academics have far more control over our time than a lot of people, than a vast majority of people do. So we have the option of turning the cell phone off. On our campus in particular, and in the college Ben and I are in, there's an informal expectation that you don't have to respond to an email for 24 hours. It didn't used to be there, but it is now. If you talk to the college deans, they say, you don't have to respond to us for 24 hours. So it's slowed a lot of things down. And it's slowed the volume of things that we get down. Now, we still get an absurd amount of email, but it cuts back on it quite a bit when you just slow it down.
So there is starting to be some pushback to this.
Yes.
We're going to take a quick break here. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. We're talking about the evolution of the modern workplace and how technology has helped us, and also the cons of all of this technology at our fingertips all the time. With me, Kevin Light. He is director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa, and Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the evolution of the modern workplace and the role that technology plays in how we work in some fabulous ways and also in some very detrimental ways as well. We want to hear your stories. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or post on our Facebook page. Maybe you're one of those people who has been able to use technology to give yourself a lot of freedom and flexibility. Maybe not. Let us know. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Kevin Light. He is a professor, department chair, and director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa. Also, Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. I have a Facebook post from Torquil. He says, for those of us who do all our work on computers and have flexible bosses, it is possible to do a lot more extensive traveling and also to work without leaving the house. I love that I don't have to go to the office on days when I'm too busy or when I have a nasty cold. So there are people who are still feeling the benefits of this technological shift. And have we seen people taking advantage of it to be able to pick up their kids or go to their kids' baseball games and do things that maybe they couldn't have done even 10 years ago?
I think we're seeing that. The real question I would have for the Facebook poster is, so if you go to your child's baseball game or you have a cold and you have to stay at home and lay in bed, do you turn your electronics off while you're there? So that's sort of the question. And it is true that undeniably you gain a lot of flexibility. And for a lot of people in large cities, getting out of commuting every day where the commute might be an hour and a half, 2 hours each way is a massive time killer and stress producer. So being able to avoid that's, I think, in itself a big deal. But then the question is, so are you still perpetually tethered to this stuff? Can I go hear my daughter play the violin without having my cell phone on?
Right. Well, and here's a question. If you are someone who draws boundaries, who says, I'm not going to answer the phone when I'm eating dinner with my family, I'm not going to leave the cell phone on when I go to bed at night. We talked to Joanne in the first part of the show, and she said they have a no technology in the bedroom rule at their house. Don't take the cell phone with you to bed at night and scroll through your email when you're trying to go to sleep. So if you're somebody who draws those boundaries, and there is someone else that you work with who does not draw those boundaries, does that put you at a tremendous disadvantage in the modern workplace?
I would agree that there is a significant pressure, a work culture that we're involved with, not just at our jobs, but in the larger culture. Indeed, there is this emphasis on work. At the university, we claim to prepare people to work. That's why we're doing what we're doing. That's our major excuse for being professors and so forth, that somehow what we're teaching relates to a job. But for the technology, I think it could free us. It's up to us. It's up to our attitude, dependent on our attitudes and opinions. If we use technology to free us, we certainly could. I think the reason we're not, and the reason we're so stressed at our jobs, the job is seeming to engulf our lives, is because we really don't know there's an option. The reason I wrote Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, is to recall the old vision of people like Walt Whitman, Dorothy Canfield Fisher, Frank Lloyd Wright, Robert Hutchins, tons of folks
it's heresy to say this, but Karl Marx said the ideal world was to work in the morning and fish in the afternoon.
Right, and he saw the opening realm of freedom, Marx did, as the shortening hours of labor. And that was part of not just an idealistic or utopian vision. It's on the ground with American labor pressing for short hours. You have all these people like Walt Whitman saying that this is America's future, higher progress, this vision that we've lost. And that, for me, one of the primary reasons we are working ourselves to death. We don't see that there has been this traditional option, this traditional alternative that, for me, is very inspiring. Walt Whitman, for example, how can you not love this man? He writes about a democratic vistas in which we will progress in our humanity, in our ability to live with each other, to enrich our associations, our families, our neighborhoods, our communities, our schools, where we'll develop those skills. That would be real progress. That would put in the shade mere technological advances, airplanes and highways and cities would be great, but even outshining those accomplishments would be this crowning jewel of American progress. Remember the words of the old America the Beautiful that should be our national anthem, and crown thy good with brotherhood. That is the vision that we've lost, that there is an opportunity, a possibility of enriching our lives, not just with work and money and so forth, but in those free realms, humane and moral progress people used to talk about. That is the vision that I'm trying to recall in this book, that I think if we have that vision, we would make it happen.
Well, let's talk about right now.
Okay.
And I mean, Kevin, to return to the subject we were talking about a few minutes ago, do you think that there is so much pressure on people to be responsive that the people who are trying to redraw those boundaries and reclaim their freedom are so pressured that they can't, because they're going to lose out to other coworkers who don't draw the boundaries?
Well, increasingly, the thing that's increased the competition is the coworkers aren't necessarily the person sitting next to you at the desk. They're the person on the other side of the world that will do this work for 25% of what you're being paid, and will do it for as many hours as an employer will demand. And part of the reason that's possible is the technology makes that possible, obviously. But the other thing that makes that possible is severing consumption from actual wages that people are paid. So somewhere in the mid-1980s, right when wages went flat, we decided that you could buy a car with no money down. You could get a house with a mortgage with five different payment rates. One of them wouldn't even pay any of the principal on the mortgage or the interest. Our college students started to get credit cards in the mail that you used to have to apply for and prove that you could actually make payments on. So we allowed an elite basically to sever consumption from what people were actually paid. So then production could be moved anywhere in the world it could be put, and we would just loan people money to buy what they wanted rather than pay them in the productivity gains they produced. So part of what this fight is ultimately going to be about is technology produces these productivity gains. Who gets to benefit from that? Is it really only the top 1 to 5% of the population, or maybe 10% if you throw most of the academy in there, or are other people going to benefit from it too? And that's going to be the big debate of the future.
And John from Iowa City has a point along those lines. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I dropped into this program after it started, so maybe somebody's already made the comment. But I heard somebody say something about that this was a white collar phenomena. It's definitely a blue collar phenomena. If you've been to any job site and seen guys working in the trades, none of them can be without a cell phone. And the companies that sell tools sell special holsters for cell phones that will stand up to the abuse of the job site. These guys can't live without their cell phones. And it's both a blessing and a curse. I mean, it is a real time saver in many respects, but it also, they're answering the phone constantly.
That's a great point, John. Thank you so much for that.
Thanks for the program. Bye-bye.
Can I follow just briefly?
Sure.
That technology, it has increased the ability of people to supervise blue-collar folks on the job. Computers now monitor people working at the post office, how fast they're working, and regularly they see on their screens you're not working as fast as the person next to you. People who deliver things have their movements monitored. So the computer is big brother more and more, and the job the stressor of the job increases as somebody's watching you virtually all the time.
And this is a Facebook post from Brady. He says there seems to be some sort of unspoken rule in many workplaces that you should always have your cell phone in your pocket or attached to your hip, and that you need to answer it or respond immediately to texts and emails unless you are in some sort of emergency. One of my former employers called me several times a day when I left my phone at home and though it wasn't a dire emergency, he simply couldn't believe that I'd left it at home. Cell phones are the prime example of the double-edged sword. Let's go to Emily on the line now from Des Moines. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to make the point, what I've seen quite a bit is for managers to let go of 40 hours, they have to be able to evaluate employees based on something other than the amount of time they're in their chair. And that can be very difficult, and it means a lot more focus on outcomes and the quality of those outcomes. And to me, that's a big barrier for people having more flexibility, is just not focusing on how many hours they're there.
Kevin?
Well, and in addition to that, an employer who's trying to do that is now, because of what computers can do and what cell phones can do and what GPS devices can do, will be overwhelmed with information about what their employee is doing. And a lot of the more insightful managers are saying, just because all this data is coming in and I have it doesn't mean it's useful in any real way. So sifting through what actually affects the productivity of the worker and what is just superfluous things I don't need to know is now becoming a big, big thing, I think.
Right. And is there a limit? Emily, thank you so much for that. Is there a limit to productivity? Even if we're taking our cell phones with us all over the place and we're working on the beach when we're on vacation and we're doing all of these things and answering texts, does that make us more productive?
I think it's a function of time as well. My second book, Kellogg's 6-Hour Day, W.K. Kellogg puts in a 6-hour day and finds it much more productive per hour than an 8-hour day. And there are real examples, real world examples today at Metro Plastics in Indianapolis has a 6-hour day. And they find that per hour, people are more attentive, produce more. Because they're working 6 rather than 8 hours. Certainly the 8-hour day comes into existence with this very reason in mind, that people after 8 hours are fatigued. They get tired. They're not as productive. The 8-hour day makes sense. Now we're going beyond 8 hours, forgetting all of the research that had been done by the original scientific managers, Frederick Taylor and his group, that after 8 hours you're tired and you're not as good a worker as you are when you first start. So that we've forgotten that. We've gone into 10 hours, doctors especially. I remember being treated by a physician that was drunk with fatigue. We've forgotten those things, which is incredible to me.
We have this wonderful email from Mike. I'm sorry, Kevin, you wanted to jump in on that. Yes.
Well, and since we're all tethered to these electronic gadgets, when we do get fatigued, we are capable of doing a tremendous amount of damage much faster. So we have a few weeks ago the case of the Wall Street trader who falls asleep and trades $275 million of stocks away while he's nodding off. And you see that in medicine as well, and in manufacturing, in a lot of areas where not being attentive now has big consequences. It's not just that some little thing doesn't get done, but a whole bunch of other stuff doesn't too.
So Mike sent us this email. He says, last year when I went to Alaska on vacation, I left my company cell phone in my boss's desk drawer with a note that said, I am on vacation. Monday morning, he dialed my number with a crisis and jumped when it rang in his desk drawer. When I returned a week later, he left it on my desk with a note that said, I understand.
But, very good.
You know, it is hard to draw boundaries. And Ben, you don't actually have a cell phone, right?
I don't. That's very deliberate on my part. I've got one, but I don't know where it is. I bowed to pressure back in Christmas, and so for a gift I suggested a cell phone. But I didn't use it, and so I don't know where it is. I don't want it. There are times when I'd like to practice what my wife calls mindfulness, being with her. Entirely. We take walks with our dogs, and I try my best with her to be with her and nothing else. And having a cell phone breaks into a person's life. It divides one's attention. It fragments our souls.
And, Kevin, you've got your smartphone in front of you right now.
Yes, this is a classic case of those that cannot do teach. I've got a cell phone right here. It's a 4G, all of that. I'm hooked up all the time. But what I do try to make a conscious attempt to do is actually not use it. And especially when I'm at home, putting it someplace where I don't hear it ring, or turning the sound off so I don't hear it ring, so that I'm not constantly bothered all the time. But nonetheless, it's so tempting. It's there all the time. So I haven't taken the plunge that Ben has taken, and so I have to admit that. Yes.
Do you think that there are other countries with similar economies to ours that are doing this better? Are there other places in the world that we can look to and say, this is an example we should follow?
I think of Italy. I love that country, and the people there seem to – maybe it's my fantasy about the Italians that I know, but the people that I visited there some time ago seem to be more present.
Of course, the economic crisis in Italy right now makes us a little nervous when we think about that.
That would make you very present, yes. I can't buy any food.
Right. Well, Kevin, do you see another culture that maybe we can learn something from?
Looking around the world, I don't see too many cultures that aren't dealing with a problem like this, in part because in many parts of the world, the gadgets we have that cost a lot of money don't cost a lot of money. No. And cell phone usage is relatively cheap. So the cell phone providers, the internet providers, engage in global price discrimination where they charge people who have money a lot of money and people that don't have a lot of money not very much money. So the technology is ubiquitous. So that's so I don't see too many places where this is being dealt with better than we are.
I've got some. I remember me hunters and gatherers today, how work about 4 hours a day, and the rest of the time is peaceful, time spent with families and so forth. That's a good example. Also, a culture that's very different from our own is the American culture of 50 or 100 years ago that expected a progress to advance our humanity, humane and moral progress, as well as material progress. We'll have more of the good things of life and more time to enjoy them. And if we could recapture that old idea, that old culture, that I think would go a long way to solving some of our difficulties.
Benjamin Honeycutt, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Benjamin Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. Kevin Light, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Kevin Light, professor, department chair, and director of the Iowa Social Science Research Center at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Garrett Van Leeuwen. You can send us email anytime, day or night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about cake on the show. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.